just because you taught it doesn't mean your kids learned it. And I feel like that is like ingrained in my brain.
Welcome to Making School Matter, where we dive into the science of teaching and learning and how it is transforming education today. As more teachers and school leaders discover the power of understanding how learners make meaning and how creating the right environment can help them thrive, the more this informs our everyday practices. On this show, I sit down with educators and school leaders who are bringing brain science to life in their schools and classrooms. They're using practical strategies to make learning more engaging, responsive, and making school matter for every student. Today, I'm joined by Celeste Mahabir, the Upper School Academic Dean, Erica Clapper, our Grade 4 and 5 Dean of Academics and Student Life, and Jessica Vance, Inquiry Educator, Teacher, School Leader, Teaching and Learning Coach, and author of Leading with a Lens of Inquiry, and has a second publication that's soon to be released, which I'm super excited about. We are recording this episode like right after our last session of Detroit Country Day's annual Teaching and Learning in the Brain Conference. So thank you all for staying after and being here after a day of sharing, learning, and reflecting. Let's start with our DCDS leadership. Can you each start by introducing yourselves and sharing a bit of what brought you to Detroit Country Day School?
Well, my name is Erica Clapper, and I started back at DCDS in 2008. I was very excited to join this school. I was a Montessori teacher before coming here, and 7 years in Montessori, and this was our feeder school. All of our students always applied and were eager to see if they were, if they got in. And so I was excited to learn more about DCDS. I knew I loved private education. I wanted to stay in private education. And then when I came and met with the head of school at the time, and he focused that all decisions were made based on student needs, and that the needs of the students came first, I was hooked. And so I've been really happy here ever since.
So my name is Celeste Mahabir, and I actually started at Country Day in 1996. Can you believe it's been that long? And when I came here, I was fresh out of graduate school, did not know that this was going to be a long-term experience for me. And in fact, I left after 10 years to work at a nonprofit organization that worked with students in our area. And I returned to Country Day. I kept finding myself missing Country Day. Why? Because I just love working with excited students and an incredible creative group of faculty who are passionate about learning, passionate about working with children. And I've done a lot of things here ever since. And yeah, thanks, Mike.
Of course. And, being a first year Detroit Country Day faculty member, I want to thank you both for a warm welcome and for being great thought partners. So thank you so much. Jessica, welcome to the show. We had a lovely, provoking day with you facilitating professional learning this morning and this afternoon. Can you share a bit about yourself and what brought you to inquiry-based learning?
Yes, of course. You did a really amazing job of introducing me. So I guess I'll just kind of jump into how I fell into inquiry-based learning, really. I moved from California at a very traditional private Armenian school and had no idea what inquiry was, and applied to a bunch of schools, happened to fall into an IB school, which takes an inquiry stance, and just fell head over heels in love with the approach and had to unlearn all the things that I thought that I learned or that I knew about teaching. And then from that space and place, just really wanted to be an inquiry leader, if you will, or be able to provide that experience for schools and continue to cultivate that for adult learners as well, too. So, yeah, really fell into it and had no idea it existed. And I'm like, man, I was under a rock. Like, I really wish that I knew what this was when I was in university as well. Gosh, I'm just so curious what my trajectory would have been if I had started there.
Yeah, you know, when I was in university thinking about the constructivist approach to education, I learned a lot about, you know, Jerome Bruner and John Dewey, all those folks. And those ideas are really still prominent today as well. But it wasn't until I stumbled onto the work of Ron Richhart, Mark Church, and Creating Cultures of Thinking, where I was like, wow, this I can see myself here. Mm-hmm. And thinking about that through the lens of an artist, people hadn't thought about that quite yet, right? The work wasn't there yet. And so thinking about how to unpack that in an artist classroom really made me think about my everyday practices. And that caught the attention of Ron Richhart. And he's visited my classroom, I think, like now 4 times, right? Oh, and when you have a senior researcher in your classroom, you become so hyper-focused on your own pedagogy because you know somebody's there like doing action research in your classroom. So it really made me think about the language I use, the way I use time, the way I, you know, ask questions, what the learners are doing at different parts of the block. And that's kind of really helped me unpack what it means to be or what it means to teach from an inquiry stance. Mm-hmm. Thinking about your keynote, you described teachers this morning as facilitators and observers of inquiry. Mm-hmm. So what does that look like in practice, and how can educators strike that right balance between guiding student learning and stepping back to let that curiosity take the lead?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an ebb and flow. An educator just recently shared with me the symbolism of an accordion. And she said, our roles as facilitators of inquiry is to think about an accordion where we're pulling back and we're pushing in, and we're pulling back and pushing in. And through the strategies and structures that honor an inquiry-based approach to teaching and learning, and also through leadership as well, I think about that. So it's, how do we take our curriculum standards and skills, and within that, can we uncover a provocation that creates that spark for our students to be able to ask some questions, or at least have a sense of wonder to be able to explore, right? So there's that invitation that we do as facilitators, allow our students to investigate and explore what that looks like and sounds like, ask some really intentional questions, just like you said, such as like, I'm curious that, or I'm noticing that you're noticing, right? Lifting those things up, noticing and naming, that's Guy Claxton works right there. And so that way students see what it is that we want them to see. It's a difference between tasking and telling and being a sage on a stage. And there is direct instruction. Sometimes we do share something and we need that direct instruction. It happened today in the auditorium, right? I needed to teach the group about what a provocation was. But I didn't say, today we're going to learn about a provocation. I started with the provocation to talk about what it means to be in the learning zone and how does that connect to brain science and what curiosity does for the brain as relates to engagement and that meaningfulness piece. Of course, too, I just asked some questions, and I say questions are a huge part of it. There's an intentionality around our language as inquiry educators. It's not just asking a question for the sake of it, but how might we ask a question and then what is it that we're listening for? And so we talked this morning about being really keen and really aware of those things that we're listening for, the patterns of thinking, misconceptions, those learner interests, and how are these like collections of data? Like you have, you know, that background in Montessori, so this is definitely speaking your language and your experience as well too. And it's a dance, and sometimes we fumble and we fall. And sometimes we misjudge the data and we think that it says one thing when it's actually something else. So it's really being transparent and pausing to reflect and sharing our reflections with our learners. I know yesterday we unpacked this and actually I did some thinking and, right? Like that's really, really powerful. So our learners know that we don't have to have all the answers, and what we thought we knew can actually be something different. Again, I know not an inquiry educator, but definitely an inquiry mindset. Adam Grant, like he has a whole book called Think Again, right? Like how do we think about our thinking differently? So I'd say, you know, for listeners, really, I like to think about like a lesson, if you will, in like three stages. Like, what's our invitation, our introduction? That can be really short. So it's like that provocation or retrieval, you know, 5-10 minutes, right? Then what's our investigation? There's that accordion where we're going to allow some space for our learners to explore. We're leaning in and conferring. And then how are we using consolidation or that final reflection to be able to lift up the big skills and ideas or have some artifacts that we want to take away to be able to reflect on to plan our next steps?
So I've been fortunate to learn from many outstanding Reggio Emilia teachers, specifically around the power of provocation for investigations, for children to engage with their environments as they explore and make more meaning of the world around them. But I'm curious about the use of provocations with more advanced learners. And you talked a bit about it during your keynote, but I want to dig in here too. Like, what role do provocations play in secondary classrooms?
A huge role. And I don't think it's just secondary classrooms. Like, adult learners need provocation too, right? Like, the world is filled with provocation. But how do we plan for provocation? I just say it's like, who are our learners? What do we know about them? What are their background skills and talents that they're bringing to the space? And how can we use those to align? And gosh, with our older learners, we can do so much. Like, they're not necessarily always limited by not being able to write, right? And I know some that might be a limitation, of course, too. But how can we, you know, take an artifact or a photo or a video they saw on TikTok and use that as a provocation, because we know that something that is really meaningful to them or really valuable to them. And we know that because we build those really foundational relationships with our learners, and how can we always be keenly looking for those? So I'd say this morning, you know, I shared with you that Google extension Get Pocket. Like, I'm constantly curating provocation, things that I think that might be interesting. I'm really listening to my own children at home. What are the things that they're, you know, kind of tuned into? And just having like a warehouse of things that I can pull from and make sure that I can connect that to the curriculum. And so I'd say, gosh, there's a world of possibility. I'd say the challenge here is that by the time our students get to that secondary level, they have been schooled out of the curiosity has been schooled out of them, right? And they just want to get through the thing. And they just want to have this be that transaction, right? We're living in kind of that TikTok world, really. And so it's not their fault. And also, how do we leverage that? We can't just say, no, you shouldn't want to do that because they want to. How can we empower them and empower our own practice and thinking about it a little bit differently?
Yeah, I know that I've gotten some ideas of provocations from Trevor McKenzie's Instagram reels too, and use those in the classrooms too. So there are so many libraries out there that have already been curated for you, but you run across so many things that you're interested in or catch your attention that you might want to collect too as you go.
I think you make a really important point about this. I think at the secondary level, it's even more important to think about these things because of that transactional nature and that pressure our students are feeling, especially in situations where they're thinking about those outcomes. And, you know, if it's a college admissions or what's next after high school or just get through because I'm just supposed to be here, whatever that reason is, we need to give them more meaning and more connection to that reason than just doing the next thing, because so much opportunity is missed if that's why they're there. And if frankly, it's not fun for the teacher either. That's not why we're in the business of educating high schoolers. And the point you made, Jessica, about, you know, knowing your students and thinking about them. And I think that's also so meaningful, especially when we're talking about teenagers who don't always feel connected, that if we have that connection and we can find those things. You know, I think about anatomy class here and, you know, our kids are all athletes and somebody comes in, they've got one of those little wheelie things because the Achilles tendon tore, or they've got an MCL because, you know, whatever. But now, okay, let's dissect that. What's happening? You know, oh, there's an ACL. Oh, why are girls getting ACL tears? You know, like, how are we getting them thinking about the things that really matter, that are exciting to them, that are interesting to them? And making it more than just, I have to do this because everybody says I have to do this, and that it's intrinsic and important to them. So I think that's a really valid point you made.
I would bet, too, that it shifts the energy of the secondary classroom when a teacher is leading with provocation.
Absolutely.
It probably just Agreed. Leads everyone down a totally different road, which is really exciting for the learner. So it's a gift that educator is giving their students when they walk in the door.
Well, let's dive into the classrooms for a minute, because I know we all do learning walks here at DCDS, and I've learned so much about the culture of thinking and learning and teaching from my short 9 or 10 months that I've been here already through learning walks. I wonder, you know, what opportunities have you noticed or that you've created in our classrooms where students engage in learning through provocation, whether through questionings or certain dilemmas or real world challenges? And, you know, how have you seen this approach impact students' thinking and engagement in our classrooms here?
I'd like to begin by saying our 4-5 art teacher, Mrs. Park, started a program this year called the Visiting Artist Program. And she actually becomes a student in the classroom with the students when we have these artists come in. And it's fantastic to see the students excited about the new visitor, learn a little bit about them before they come, and then actually get to practice the art of that artist with them. So recently we had someone come in where the children listened to jazz, and then they actually painted the patterns that they were seeing in their mind on canvases. And Mrs. Parks joined right in. So giving those opportunities for our students to see themselves and their teachers learning side by side is pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually see a lot of that, particularly in our StanX class, because our teachers are venturing into this new world, dealing with the genetics of fruit flies, and there's going to be mistakes. These fruit flies are going to die. Things are going to happen, and the teachers are alongside the students doing the class, learning as they go. And I think that's just so real for our students in terms of giving them that experience and also getting them excited that it isn't an us and a them, it's a we. And I think that's really important. And I mean, there's just so many ways, so many little ways, so many big ways that are happening. As you walk the halls, you know, I watched the history classes walking through Egyptian tombs with virtual reality. just to start, just to think about it and start to see how they see themselves in some of the visuals that they're seeing, and starting to ask questions. Why would you bother to do this? Why would they do this? Why are they spending so much time and energy on this? And just getting that going, and then connecting to the kinds of things we have in our world that mimic that kind of idea.
And going back to the power of a learning walk and encouraging each other to do that on a regular basis, I think has such a great impact on our community as a whole. Even walking into Mrs. Hahn's music class recently, and she sat down and really dissected an entire piece of music with the students. And I found myself with my own mouth like dropped open and thinking, I never even thought about how the melodies are put together like that. And it's so powerful for us to experience that in each other's classrooms and model that.
Absolutely.
And you were talking about using VR as a provocation.
Yeah.
I remember being in Randy Kaplan's class, and we were talking about the idea of a hero and what makes a hero, and what then transforming it into what makes an epic hero. And so we used AI as a way to create an image of somebody who they knew as their hero. And then through interacting with AI and through interacting with the text, change that image into an epic hero and kind of use that as the provocation for understanding the character in the book, connecting it to a character that they knew, but using that technology to help support it. I thought it was a really interesting way of leveraging that emerging technology in ways that connect directly to the curriculum.
Excellent. I love that.
One challenge that I faced when shifting my own practices is kind of resisting the urge to immediately provide an answer. And we talked about that in my sessions today, too. But wait time is so important for thinking. And the trouble is that when I thought I had to get through all of the material, regardless if the learners understood it or not, I would ask a question and then the first student would raise their hand. I'd call on them and get the correct response and then move on. Jessica, I wonder, like, what strategies might help educators slow down and allow for that time for thinking?
Yeah, a few things come to mind. I think it's actually even a quote from Trevor McKenzie is, just because you taught it doesn't mean your kids learned it. And I feel like that is like ingrained in my brain. I don't know if it was him speaking or just us having a conversation. I feel like that's always stuck with me. But as far as strategies go, I mean, I think thinking routines are a really fantastic way. You know, you had mentioned that a little bit of shifting your practice, because they're this thing, a structure, and all teachers like a structure. That's kind of why we're here, right? A structure that helps you slow down the transaction of thinking. But it does it in a way at this like higher level where you're being really intentional to even think about what do you want to get from that. So I'd say, you know, thinking routines are really great. To me, Mike, you know me, but honestly, my kind of like back pocket trick is just to ask a question, because then I am not giving an answer. So, you know, what makes you say that? And what else? Tell me more. I'm curious about, right? And I'd say if our learners look at us with like deer in the headlights when we're asking, that probably also tells us that we haven't nurtured that curiosity within that space. And there's nothing wrong, but that's a really good data point too, as you're going on learning walks and you see that in maybe particular classrooms or certain sections or grade levels. And it's like a really great aha moment, I think, as school leaders for us to consider, what are we missing here? How might we continue to nurture that? So questions, thinking routines to me are go-tos. And then, you know, how do we have some visual cues within our room to remind us to lean into questions as well, too? Everybody needs that visual reminder. I've even seen teachers actually, they'll put their hands behind their back as almost just kind of like a physical reminder that they are not to jump in. And so that's kind of like their go-to as they're moving around the room, is they'll put their hands behind their back, and that's like their cue, like, don't say anything, just kind of lean in. So a few things to kind of give a go and give a try if it's a habit of yours or if you're listening right now.
I think that question happens a lot, especially at the secondary level, because there is that pressure for content and coverage. And maybe it's because I'm an economics teacher. No, it probably is. But the word productivity comes to mind. And if you're just telling them and they aren't learning, then you really haven't done anything with your content. You haven't moved forward. But if you are taking the time, you're allowing the processing, you're allowing this to happen, you actually will become more productive. I don't want to say speed up necessarily in terms of being able to get through material, mm-hmm. but truthfully, if you're productive, you've done a whole lot more. Mm-hmm. And I think getting that mindset for a lot of educators is difficult because it's a risk taking at the very beginning to develop those processes. But once you get there, I do think you can see a whole lot more get done. Again, that's where I'm at.
You know, I just want to add on is that having leaders like you make all the difference. Teachers have to know it's okay to slow down. Mm-hmm. Teachers have to know that it's okay to not like rush through something. And as leaders, we need to continuously remind our teachers it's okay. They're going to forget. They're going to feel the pressure of testing or the curriculum or what it says or some sort of score. And so we really have to do our due diligence as inquiry leaders to say, like, it's okay if you don't finish. Like, what's important is the thinking here, because we can get to go deeper instead of that surface level. So I can't say that enough. And I feel like I probably, you know, shout that off the mountaintops to school leaders, because we need to remind our teachers all the time, and they deserve it.
So I want to add, for my session today, we are using a zoom in thinking routine, really to slow down, notice detail, and make interpretations of a concept and how your interpretation changes as you uncover more of a visual image and really tune into the change in your interpretation and how that informs your understanding. And when I unveiled a little bit of the picture, somebody had said something and asked me a question. Well, I noticed this happening. And instead of me saying, yes, I see that too, and moving on, I asked them, well, what do you see that makes you think that? And they were like, oh, well, I see this, that, and the other thing. And they described what they were looking at. And then I heard somebody else go, oh, I didn't see that. And so when you slow down, when you allow for that time for unpacking the content and people sharing their interpretations of it, it's like universal design, right? You help other people see what they hadn't seen before, and that helps them understand it as we go. But I do want to circle back to your comment about teachers need to know from school leaders that it's okay to slow down and less is more and things like that. But I do want to address the elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. There are like state and national standards. And in our case, there's AP standardized curriculum benchmarks set by the College Board that are required for students. Mm-hmm. And how do teachers balance that rigorous learning goal with the openness of student-led inquiry?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I think when we encourage our teachers not only plan for the skills that are being assessed on these national state tests, and also the other, like, quote unquote, soft skills, like what are the other skills that are important to be able to do the test or to do life, right? And how might you plan with both skills in mind to get to that deeper level? And I know it's definitely a mind shift, you know, so again, we keep saying it. So it's plan with skills in mind, and oftentimes what ends up bubbling up to the surface is collaboration. If we can build up the skill of collaboration, who's doing the heavy lifting? The students are doing the heavy lifting and talking between each other. Then we can better assess whether or not our students know it or they don't know it. We can't just live in a state of constantly preparing for the test to do better at the test. That does not work. We have to spend more time in the formative. And that formative space means that we're not practicing for the test, but we're practicing with our peers. We're engaging in collaborative structures, right? We're asking some questions to dive deeper. We're teaching our students how to ask questions. What are the skills of reflection, right? Like, the skill of reflection is actually a multitude of five other skills. And what is that? And how do we plan for that? What does that look like and sound like? And then even too, with some of the science of reading research, mm-hmm. right? It tells us that you need to have a lot of experience in a lot of different things to be able to make those conceptual connections and to be able to go deeper. If we're wanting in secondary for students to understand what conflict is, we can't wait until secondary to start teaching about it. We need to be talking about conflict early on. And even though the topics might seem kind of surface level, we're adding to that knowledge bank of learning, right? So what does a government system look like with kings and queens? And we're talking about that in kindergarten. That's piquing their interest. That's really exciting. Do they need to know all the nobility? No. And also, those structures and systems around that also help that conceptual and deeper knowledge a little bit later. So really, it's like we spend that time exploring those concepts so we can get to places that truly have that learning transfer later.
Our 4-5 ELA teachers are doing a deep dive right now into the writing rope mm-hmm. and the reading rope. And and these are veteran teachers who have well over, you know, 20 plus years of experience. And I just was telling Celeste earlier how much I commend them for their passion. And they're like, let's boil this down again. Let's, you know, remold it and reform things that haven't worked in the past based on research, based on the science of reading and writing. And it's fantastic because, like the reading rope and the writing rope, unless you have all of those strands mm-hmm. that are connecting to all the different types of content area, then you're not going to have that solid, you know, author or that solid reader as they're growing up through the years. So it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Brett Seidel. He's one of our social studies teachers here, 20-year veteran teacher, fantastic person. Kids kind of just gravitate to him in his room. And I had the pleasure of partnering with him for a couple of different classroom projects. And he was in one of my sessions this morning. And we wound up skipping a whole section of my presentation because of a question that he had asked and dove into it. Like, he really wanted to know the art of questioning, right? The art of teaching is so broad. He really wanted to narrow it down to, how do I create that perfect question? And then we were working through a question formulation technique. So it was really like relevant that he had asked that question. And then somebody else said, well, it's not about the content, it's about the inquiry. And I was like, whoa, hold on for a second. If you just practice the skill of asking a question without connecting it to inquiry, we're just practicing. Mm-hmm. It's the application process that makes it you moving more toward understanding, right? So thinking about the skill and thinking about how we can marry that with content, the inquiry can be the fuel, and then we're moving it toward understanding. Mm-hmm. And he really liked that analogy. He was like, wait, say that again, the fuel. Because mm-hmm. we're really trying to move learners to use those skills of answering questions, creating questions, and driving their learning. But without that content, we really have nothing to apply it to. And so it really is kind of this marriage of both to make that happen.
Yeah, I just want to jump in and say I called it an engine recently. It was our 4 or 5 math team is using the Routines for Reasoning and the Teaching for Thinking as their engine in their math department right now. And they practiced some of those strategies with us where they, you know, showed us a question up on the board and we weren't asked to solve the problem. We were asked to come up with the strategies that we will use in order to come up with the solutions. And then they took the problem away. So it didn't even give you the time to mentally start to calculate anything before they said, you saw, you know, a snapshot of that problem. Now talk about what strategies are you going to use? What kind of thinking do you need to evoke in your, you know, collaborative conversation with your partner in order to come up with the strategies to solve the problem? And it slows them down. It makes them like, oh gosh, I just want to see the numbers and solve the problem. Because like you said, we're in such a like shorts version of society right now where everyone's just scrolling and swiping that it's like making the intentional time to slow down and have those questions is so important in the learning process.
And then when you get that, everything that is complicated, the content becomes more accessible and you can construct meaning from it. And I think that's the key. And again, it goes back to the productivity and I'm all about that.
Well, from an econ teacher, of course.
Well,
right?
And yeah, but truly, if you have those processes and you practiced and you think about how to ask questions, to think about your process, to follow some routines, then you're not going to be intimidated as things get more complicated. You're going to have the tools to do that deeper dive and add and add and add. And that, I think, is what then gets us to the question of how do we get them to the next level if we don't want to focus on that too much. But yeah, there you go.
And it's shifting their mindset, right? It's when they come in, practicing an opportunity where there can be multiple answers and yeah. then discussing that. So you're shifting them from this competitive, there's got to be a right answer or a wrong answer to a, wow, there really could be more than one answer here. And it's a matter of the strategies that I put in place to come up with my solution. And that's where deeper thinking starts happening.
And I can explain how I arrived at what I came to.
Yes.
And that's that whole, what is the visible thinking I'm doing?
Yes.
And that, again, and connecting to their metacognition and them being able to then take control of it for themselves so that when they go beyond our walls, they don't need us. They don't,
you know. And they're comfortable taking those risks.
They're good.
Yes.
You know, one thing that came up during my session was the power of language. And I know Jessica uses I invite you to often. And one thing that we had talked about in formulating questions is changing the word do. One of the things that we had talked about is just changing the word do to might. So how might you? And when we're talking about divergence, how do you takes you to one answer.
Mm-hmm.
How might you invites the divergent thinking there. And it's such a little shift. It's a mindful shift, but it's such a little shift to make that can change the culture of the way that you use language in your classroom and invite kids to think like there's more than one way of doing it. Even in a math class where you're like looking for that end result and that end result is an equation or number that's definite, there are playful and different ways of getting there. And one thing that we talked about with some of our lower school teachers is the idea of number talks. And so often when we talk about math, we start from the beginning and work our way toward the end, which is the answer. But what if we started with the answer first? The answer is 7. What's the problem? How do you get there? And then we're actually talking about the concept of numeracy. But it's such a small shift. It's a little shift to make, and I think that can end in some big results. I want to go back to some of the things we had been talking about grades and optics and things. So for schools and classrooms, teachers and students often are hyper-focused on grades. The products, the AP recommendations, the transcript optics, it is rather difficult to shift the perspective lens to process and struggle rather than product and result. So Jessica, you emphasize the importance of observing and documenting student thinking.
Mm-hmm.
How can teachers use grading and documentation to guide learning rather than just recording outcomes?
I mean, you just segue so nicely into learning walls and the documentation process. Documentation has been something that the last, probably decade, but really the last handful of years have been researching quite intensely. And I'd say, how are we documenting the process and using our expertise to be able to collect and select artifacts for that evidence so that way our students can self-assess, we can formatively assess where the thinking is at. And again, learning walls don't have markings. Like when we're collecting those artifacts, it should not have a grade. If we have grades on there, those need to be taken down, really, quite frankly. We want to have that not be a part of that process of learning. And yes, the end product might have a mark, but how could also the evidence that we collect help students assess whether or not they're ready for that marking or they deserve that marking, right? What might that look like and sound like? I'd say definitely in the secondary space, probably a lot harder if it's also our culture. And I'd say, as school leaders, like how are we creating opportunities for our parents to know more and our parents to know better? We don't know what we don't know until we know it. So how do we create that space where they can see what that looks like and sounds like? They're only relying on the grades. Yes, some systems definitely feed that kind of beast, but they're only doing that because that's what they experienced when they were going to school. So can we show them something different? So I find that, if I can share like Harvard Business Review or just different types of research that's happening, in the corporate world, right? Or maybe some brain science, of course, there too. So we can begin to see a different way. I think also begins to start to shift a school culture. Could it be in a weekly email that you send to your community? Hey, this week when you're chatting with your students or your children, here's a couple of questions you could ask. I wonder what you find out, right? And just kind of beginning to nurture what that looks like and sounds like. And if anything, probably most parents that you ask here, right? If you said like, what does it mean to be educated? I don't know if they're going to say it means I get an A. Maybe, right? But that's probably going to be lower on their list as well, too. So some things to try, again, like we're kind of like faced with this bigger like beast, right? And also what's happening in colleges right now. If you look at the research about what professors are saying in colleges, kids are not ready for college. They don't have the aptitude to sit there and sit in the rigor because they don't know how to ask questions. And it didn't matter that they got the A. They can't read a whole novel on their own because they just cheated their way around the system, right? And that's what a lot of the research is saying from the top colleges around the world is those things aren't necessarily producing what we want. So I think there's also a lot of conversation, too, around what's happening in the college level as well, too. And how can we bring that forth to our parent community? Right. And that's where I think we can begin to see some shifts and changes in regards to mindset of our school communities, too.
Yeah, I think it's where we put the focus. And when you had talked about learning walls, it reminded me of a third grade classroom I was working with. And we did a tug of war with the book, Mr. Popper's Penguins. And they've read that book, for 30 years in that classroom. And the teachers invited me into their planning to say, hey, we'd like to do something different. And so I encouraged them to, think about the moral dilemma in that book. And we posed the question to the kids as they were reading the book, are animals better off in captivity or in the wild? And we did a tug of war on that. And they initially, most of them put they're better off in the wild. And as they read the book, their thinking has changed. Like you had mentioned, moving your thinking one way or the other on the tug of war is, it's a sophisticated way of thinking. But one thing I added, because we were focusing on comprehension, so one thing I added to it is, if you were going to move, we had sticky notes where your thinking was, if you were going to move it one way or the other, you left a residual sticky lower, like right under where your original sticky was, that marked where your thinking was and the reason why you moved it to the next location. So you can follow, here's where my thinking was, here's where my thinking went, and here is the why behind it. And when you're thinking about like assessing understanding, yes, you can ask multiple choice questions. You can ask them to fill out, you know, so a questionnaire about it, you know, to check for understanding. But you make the learning visible to parents who come in to drop their children off to the classroom, classes that go from, you know, to specials or whatever, they can pass by and see that. And it's just a way of honoring the thinking that's happening in the classroom. And it's an assessment of your comprehension of the book, but it's not graded. Mm-hmm. And it was a place where kids would come and like want to see the changes that has happened. It's a dynamic, like learning walls need to be dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a way to kind of keep that thinking flowing, and also that form of assessment that's not particularly tied to a grade, but still shows the change in understanding.
Yeah, I mean, once you put a marking on something, the learning kind of just stops. I got the A, I got the B, I got the fill in the blank that I was aiming for. So I think the learning just stops. So it's like, even if, you know, again, teachers want to know the how do I shift? Like you say, no marks. Okay, now how do I do this, right? So it's like leaning into formative assessment too. How can we provide that feedback or teach students to know how to give and get feedback between ourselves? Or how do we have a richer conferring process, right? So again, why I love learning walls and that documentation process.
Yeah. I think your initial question, Mike, really resonates with me, because as the academic dean in an upper school, I'm dealing all the time with those grades and transcripts and what that means and where that student's headed, and what, you know, the conversations with parents, conversations with students. And I think with what you said, Jessica, as well, it all comes down to helping students have ownership of authentic learning, mm-hmm. right? And ways that you can do that. And it's difficult. It's absolutely difficult, because you are dealing with internal structures, external structures, you know, what people
old
are.
Mindsets.
Yeah. And you know, the pieces that I see our faculty doing really, really well, and I see it some in our middle school, and I know that's done there, and I know it's done here, is a lot of self-reflection as documentation of learning. And one of the greatest things that I see happening in terms of this is our chemistry teacher, Rich Fitzner, who started 3 years ago a process of ungrading. And to Erica's point, I mean, this is a teacher who has been here and in education for a long time, and he is reinvigorated by this ungrading, which there was not a lot of research on doing that in a science classroom. A lot of that was out there for humanities-based classes, particularly writing, and, you know, telling students, here's the outcome of, you know, what you need for chemistry, the skills and the content of chemistry. Now, let's see how we're going to get to this work and get through it. And so he's teaching his class the way he would teach his class, except that the grading is done by the students, and it's one-on-one conversation about assessments and ownership of the learning. And the amazing thing is, his research has been to collect, you know, he's graded it the way he would have graded it and kept that data to himself, mm-hmm. while watching students, and he videos them while they talk through what they're doing one-on-one, and their grades and the, you know, the numbers, they're pretty aligned, but this student is authentically understanding what they know about chemistry, what they don't know about chemistry. And we're still able to provide that external need for a transcript grade, right? And I think those are the kinds of things that have real possibility for students in this situation that we're talking about.
So in my session this morning, we went through the QFT question formulation technique, where we produced questions and then improved on our questions and then prioritized our questions. I wonder if, Jessica, I can ask you some questions that bubbled to the top from our session?
Sure.
Okay.
Happy to.
Here we go. What foundational skills do students need in order to balance structure and flexibility?
Foundational skills, I'd probably say reflection. And when I talk about reflection, really, it's a collection of skills. So I'd say reflection really is collaboration. How do our students know how to collaborate with others, with adults, right? What does that look like and sound like? Of course, there's curiosity. So that is asking questions, right, and knowing what a good question is or maybe what a better one might be in a different moment. Also, the skill of listening is embedded with the skill of reflection, right? What are we listening for? How do I listen? How do I know what's really important? It says also relationships are a huge part of that as well, too. Those are essential skills that students have to practice and falter and struggle and maybe not do amazing and also do really well as too. So I'd say I know there's like a collection of five things that I listed, but overarching that is the skill of reflection. And then also too, like things need to be hard because that's how we overcome. And kids are really resilient. Mm-hmm. We just got to give them the space and we are too, right? But again, like the transactional nature of our society is like rewarding just kind of like that shorts mentality, like you said. And so how do we create spaces in which we do that, right? So a collection of skills to consider. And I may be biased because I love reflection because it's at the heart of inquiry, but truly it helps us in so many different ways and spaces too.
I'm finding a common thread here. Both of these questions have to do with what students need. So what do students need to drive their inquiry?
I think what I've already shared, and then also adults who create that psychological safety and space for them to go try and to fail and say it's okay, right? Today during the session, I shared, you know, a get unstuck wall. And that's because we want you to like figure out how to get unstuck, right? That cognitive friction is good. And that resiliency space is where we kind of build that. So not being afraid to shy away from that. And when things don't go well, that's an opportunity for us to reflect. What didn't go well? What went well? What do you want to do differently next time? How do you know? And giving learners an opportunity to find and figure out what that looks like. And if they can't identify it in themselves, then that's where we get to be that nurturing support or say, hey, I noticed this, or I also saw that, and be that coach and that guide on the side.
I'll often say to my 4 or 5 kids at school, you know, I'm so glad you made this mistake and you get to learn this now. Mm-hmm. This is so awesome. And we'll call home and chat about it with mom. And it becomes a partnership, an opportunity for that child to grow rather than them feel bad for the choice that they made. It's like, oh, okay, well now and I always say when you know better, you do better.
Yes.
And so that is, you know, something we reemphasize over and over throughout the year.
I think that safety is so important especially as students get older. And they feel the pressures socially, they feel the external pressures, and again, those outcome pressures. I mean, to your point, Erica, I actually thank my seniors when they make a mistake because they say, okay, great, now I get to talk about this. And we can explore why this doesn't work because this is something people do make a mistake doing. And creating that safety for kids as they move through adolescence is so, so significant in your classroom.
Mm-hmm. We do have to honor that many teachers are at different parts of the continuum when it comes to teaching with an inquiry stance. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, for teachers that are ready to take that next small step toward inquiry-based learning, like what are some small but impactful changes teachers can make tomorrow to embrace the role of facilitator and observer or brain changer when it comes to mind-brain education?
I think we've said it a couple of times today, and I'll just say it again. I said lean in with another question. Resist the urge to answer. And resist the urge to task and tell. And could you just have a collection of like a few questions on a sticky note near your plan book, on your phone, on the wall, so that way you just lean in with another question, right? We ask a whole lot of questions of our students about what they're doing, right? Instead of like what their experience is like. And so I think that's really powerful. It's really intentional, right? I asked everybody today to set an intention, and it's all about intentionality. Can we be more intentional with our words and how we show up? How do our words invite a different kind of thinking that we're hoping to nurture? And then also too, like there's another sentence stem for you, but I wonder what would happen if we did. Like what happened if we would start with a question instead of an answer, right? And then see what happens, right? We might fumble and fall, right? And what might that look like and sound like? And then I'd say this is another piece too, is find a critical thought partner and friend. Have that person that can be your guide on the side. You can co-teach and go try something new that you've been scared to do, but you have somebody in the room to kind of help you. Get into each other's spaces. See what it, quote unquote, could look like and sound like, because it looks different because your learners are different and they're older or they're younger or they have more experience or less experience. And so having that intentional language and that intentional thought partner friend to me are like such game changers and really connect and bring us all together too.
It's time to wrap up and reflect. This is a question that I ask all my guests at the end of the episodes. I look forward to all of your responses. In the context of teaching and learning, would you please complete the sentence, "I used to think and now I think"?
I'll start. I used to think that those who wrote books had all of the answers and best teaching practices. And now I know that the wisdom is in the room and in the communities and classrooms and spaces that we nurture.
That's a good one. Can't steal that one.
No.
I don't know that I thought that, though. So I
yeah, you can't take that, right?
I didn't think that.
I would say that I used to think that I had to, like, model the exemplary. And now I know I should model the mistakes. I should model the fumbles. I should model the, oh, my gosh, I don't know what I was thinking. And I hope people can grow up from that.
Can I steal that? That's fantastic.
Plus
that's
one.
That's true. The first year I taught here, every mistake was hyper.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
I mean, we're at Country Day, right?
Yeah, so those kids were on me.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, here it is. I used to think that all of the teachers around me had it all together and knew all the answers because they always looked calm and relaxed on their way to class. And now I know we all get that little butterfly in our stomachs. We're all thinking about, like, the tensions and the things that we're worried about. And they all come from a good place. But, you know, mom spaghetti is happening for all of the faculty around here.
Yeah,
I just threw that out there for you.
Well, thank you, Celeste, Erica, and Jessica.
Thank you for having us.
On behalf of everyone at Detroit Country Day School, thank you for listening to the Making School Matter podcast, powered by the studios at DCDS. If you have enjoyed our time together, please like, share, and subscribe. For more episodes, you can find us on all of the popular podcast sites. For more information on Mind, Brain, and Education, or learning more about Detroit Country Day School, please visit dcds.edu. To learn more about Leading with Inquiry and Learning Walls, please visit leadingwithinquiry.com or follow @Jess_VanceEDU on Instagram. Until next time, I'm your host, Mike Medvinsky, and I encourage you to look closely, think deeply, and wonder incessantly.
Yay.
And that's the way we do a podcast.
That's awesome.
Great.